Okay, thanks for that introduction, Graham and Simona. I'm going to be talking about employees supporting the learning and training development of other employees. And my talk is going to be in sort of five parts, but I assume that one of the things we can actually do is, if occasionally I pause, if people have actually got any questions on that sort of particular section, we can actually take those as we go along. And the first thing I wanted to say was that this, what I'm going to be talking about is coming from sort of two sources. One is our work at the Institute for Employment Research at University of Warwick on guidance, learning and careers. And the second is it's also coming from the UK's Teaching and Learning Research Programme. And I'm the Associate Director with responsibility for workplace learning and a number of the projects, including later on Lorna's project, actually are related to that. So I wanted to talk about the importance of employees supporting the learning of other employees. And the first, in terms of the second slide, I'll be talking about the development of expertise in knowledge-intensive workplaces, such as aerospace or engineering. And I think what's interesting here is that you've actually had a shift, that in the past, a focus on development and competence was trying to see whether workers were able to do the technical tasks allied to them. Whereas in fact, that may or may not have been okay for the past, but it's certainly an insufficient basis for preparation for future performance. And this is because much learning takes place while people are working rather than in recognizable educational training settings. And in knowledge-intensive work settings, such as aerospace, it's important to look beyond the competencies as a basis for development and instead take a developmental view of expertise, which itself should be looked at as a continuing process. And okay, I was just adjusting the slides. So the interesting thing here is that if in aerospace or engineering you're faced with a complex task, then the importance is that if you're using a developmental view of expertise, you'll go beyond the technical proficiency, because within the teams associated, the sort of project teams and development teams, and also the teams concerned with sort of manufacturing, you've actually got to have people who are able to support the learning of others and also change the way things are actually developed. It's actually interesting that if you take an example like aerospace, that although airplanes may cost up to $140 million each, when you buy an airplane, you don't get something which is actually sort of fixed. Within it, there's an expectation, because it takes a couple of years to sort of develop, that changes will actually be made. So there's an expectation, and the teams will be expected to be able to make changes. And here, if you look at the competence in inventories, the first three levels are the sort of classic ones where you actually, if you're building, constructing a team, you can have people in that team who've able to perform the task a few times, people who are much more experienced. But you also need people who've got the ability to support the learning of other people. And the fifth and final one is the ability to change the way things are undertaken and how. Okay, so I was saying about the importance of supporting the learning of others at work. And one of the interesting things is actually, because this may happen, and in fact does happen very often, sort of informally, but of course, within, say, the German system of Meister qualifications, you've got up to sort of 2 million people who actually got a qualification, which actually includes the ability to support the learning of others. And I actually think it's interesting the way in which, if you've got that sort of focus and the importance and the ability within teams to support the learning of others, that is something which actually needs to be emphasized as much as, or perhaps even more than, just technical competence. So that's the end of the first part. Does anybody have any sort of direct questions in relation to that part? Okay, well, the second section I was actually going to be talking about is drawing on the Teaching and Learning Research Program of Michael Arrow and colleagues on early career learning. And here, this focused on the early career learning in nursing, engineering, and accountancy. And newly trained graduates often find there's a sort of particular challenge in terms of applying what they've learned during training. And this is very often just sort of presented as if it is a question of simple transfer of knowledge. But I think Michael Arrow here outlines that there are actually five stages to that. I won't go through all five, but once again, I'll just draw attention to the second one, the understanding the new situation, a process that often depends on informal learning. And this was common across nursing, engineering, and accountancy, that what actually happens is you've got the knowledge to link to the sort of particular situation, but you've got to recognize that that situation requires particular forms of knowledge, and you've also got to learn the ways in which you can bring that knowledge to bear.
Does anyone want to comment on these five-stage models that you've got on your screen here? I'm quite interested in Heike's comment here about Jay Cross's point that informal learning, the idea we learn is probably the most, we learn probably most informally, and yet we finance the last 10% of formal education. So for me, there's an issue there. Should we actually be putting the finances into the informal learning rather than the formal? George, yes, go ahead.
I suppose if we put the finance into the informal, it would only serve to formalize and, if I could use the term, possibly colonize the informal and perhaps compromise that 90%, as Heike puts it. Certainly agree that we probably learn most informally, but I'm not sure whether there is a... I'm not sure what the benefit is in formalizing the informal.
So I think it's actually quite interesting that you don't actually have to formalize it, but it's a case of recognition. I think it's a view that competencies are not just individual, that they can actually be held collectively, and you know, that would elevate the importance of cooperation. And I mean, it might seem blindingly obvious, but the sum of the competencies of a team are very much, very often, greater than the sum of the competencies of the individuals. And certainly in my work setting, you know, if you've got four or five people who are working sort of together, I would feel as though we were able to undertake a full range of tasks much greater than we could as five individuals. And it just seems as though what's actually required is a sort of shift to actually recognize the processes associated with informal learning are actually very important, not to sort of fully formalize them, but certainly to formalize them to a degree in the sense that you're having structures that actually try and promote them. So in, say, something like health settings, you know, the extent to which you have sort of mentoring or have sessions which actually draw to people's attention that these things are actually important. But I wonder if people have got any thoughts on that.
Heike, you wanted to say something? You've got your hand up at the moment.
Thank you. And when I just look at the slides where it says understanding the new situation, a process that often depends on informal social learning, and really the recognition that informal learning is so valuable, one thing that comes to mind is that still in companies right now, they would not allow instant messaging to be used. although Cisco and IBM and all these big companies have already issued reports and studies how beneficial for inter-colleague communication that could be, so many companies suppress that instant messaging chit-chat with the fear of that they might chit-chat to their wife at home or whatever, yeah? And this kind of recognition, as I'm not quite sure who said it earlier, is truly important to create the infrastructure for social learning within companies. I mentioned another occasion in the industry, actually. Now, some people might know, I'm not quite sure whether it was the Texas copy machines or something. Learned that from Jay Cross, actually. It was a certain company that had were just about to train their workforce to maintain these copy machines, and they thought about what kind of formal training they should invest on, and eventually what they did is they invested in walkie-talkies. They invested clerics, that was their thing to do. They invested in walkie-talkies so that the maintenance guys who were then standing alone, you know, struggling with their photocopier, were listening into the conversations between their colleagues as they were trying to solve problems, and they became one of the best copy machines of all times, and maintenance was eventually very much slowed down because of the trained, you know, skilled fitters and workforce and what have you. And that's one possible way of investing into social learning, informal social learning at workplaces, which I would like to just comment on.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. Alan, if you want to come try and get in, just turn your mic on at any time. But if we take that up, Heike, what does that mean for the training of trainers? If we're saying that basically you can develop a learning environment which is rich for informal learning, how do trainers operate in that situation? Anyone would like to comment on that new role? We're basically talking about, I suppose, changes in the roles of trainers, or are we talking about trainers becoming redundant completely? Or are we talking about new roles? And if we're talking about new roles, what are those new roles?
I think one of the important elements is actually a sort of mentoring or support role. And actually, one of the studies in terms of accountancy coming from the Michael Arrow project has audit teams, and they have nothing but trainees, and the first year trainee is expected to be supported by the second year or the third year trainee because they're close enough to support their learning and development. Okay, in an audit team, you've got the previous audit as something to actually look on, but it's actually interesting that you can actually have as one of your main components of your job supporting the learning of other people.
Would anyone else like to comment on that, or shall we let Alan go through? George, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I could just say that with respect to the role of tutors, certainly in our business school, we use simulations and case studies of audit teams in exactly the way that it would be suggested from running real audit teams of real trainees. You start off with first year undergraduates enacting the role of an audit team and managing an audit of a fictitious company. And then they go into the workplace and they take up the role of a trainee as described previously, with the experience of having simulated it in their formation, if I can call it that. So I do think that there is still a role in the traditional sense for training, but it needs to be articulated with the professional contexts.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. I think that you need to consider that interaction between the formal and I think that that link between the formal and the informal approaches to learning and development is really important as a way of sort of building on what's actually required. And I think one of the interesting things is there is the importance of mastering a knowledge base, if you like, is something which actually gives you a platform when you actually go into work to actually do the sorts of things that I was talking about in terms of understanding the new elements of the situation. You know, because if you actually put people in a completely new situation and you've got to get them to learn too much, it actually becomes too overwhelming. So there is absolutely a role for formal education and training. The other thing that I think's actually really important here is, so far I've only talked about jobs which are actually learning rich jobs. So you can actually learn by interacting within communities and network in ICT, health, engineering, and things like that. But one of the other things is the extent to which there are jobs which don't have that learning richness. So again, there would be a very strong role for education and training in those respects. And indeed, the number one way in which people develop from low-skilled jobs is to actually change jobs. So again, there would be a clear role for you know, because you're not going to be able to suddenly change the structure of employment such that all jobs have this sort of learning richness. I think the other thing which is, or the final thing I'd like to draw attention to, is the importance of sense making. There's not only personal development, but the very idea that you're actually being driven by that desire of making sense of your situation and a search for understanding and participation in networks. And again, very interestingly, that leads to people wanting to do more formal education and training. So one of the typical responses of people new to nursing or teaching is that it's overwhelming in the first year or 18 months and they don't want to do any further continuing professional development formally. But then after that period, because of this desire for sense making, the importance of, say, getting a master's or some update comes before again. So I do think there is this balance between informal and formal learning. And finally, I'd say learning from others with sort of acknowledged expertise is sometimes facilitated through particular activities, but it's sometimes through explicit knowledge development and sharing activities. And again, this difference between formal learning and informal learning can be overstated, because there are lots of cases at work in learning rich jobs where you are engaged in formal learning and development. You are actually seeking a solution to something which you don't know the answer to. You know, it is also about formal and informal learning as being on a continuum. So there's lots of informal learning taking place in formal educational settings, and there is also formal education or formal learning also taking place in the workplace when there aren't any trainers around. And that's my sort of final comment, and I, you know, wish to open it up again to sort of questions or comments.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Now, I understand from this first input that there's a strong suggestion that for the contextual or sectoral embedding, looking at the learning richness of the work environment that in a way determines the trainer's role. So, well, I understood that in those learning intensive work environments, trainers get more of the role of providing guidance and facilitating learning processes, maybe engaging people in peer learning activities, if you wish, and get a more formal role in work contexts that are less learning intensive, really by passing on knowledge or even counseling people how to broaden their skills or engage in continuing learning. Is that one of the key messages, maybe?
Yeah, certainly I think that that's exactly right. You know, that is one of the big issues and a key message that we ought to think about and move beyond sort of objectives and sort of competencies with this view that you should be trying to support the learning of others. And indeed, you know, in a large number of contexts, that's very important indeed.
But then, Alan, does that approach, and I think there was Barry just added a comment on the recognition of informal learning using the outcomes method, there's a problem here as the key aspect of informal learning is to learn something outside the box that couldn't be foreseen in advance. Does that render the competence model fairly difficult, shall we say?
Absolutely. But what I was arguing was that even within the competence model, if you went back to what I was saying about aerospace, I think that it's interesting that even if they're developing a model, they're saying that there are a couple of levels beyond, you know, technical competence. And there's not only supporting the learning of others, but there's also a sense of trying to change the way tasks are actually carried out. And that's a big challenge. And certainly from that point of view, that's a developmental view of sort of expertise. And, you know, beyond that level of technical competence, they don't do any more recognition of this. They make a note of it because they want to construct teams and they want to make sure that they've got people who are good at supporting the learning of others and people who can think about things in new ways. But they don't explicitly recognize their sort of competencies in terms of accreditation. But the key thing is they actually pay them more. You know, so that's the thing. You know, it does sort of draw attention to there are things more beyond these competencies, and there is some value in becoming more expert.
But then, Alan, you're talking about an overall model where we recognize competence not through qualifications, but through the pay structure, which is sort of a bit of a change, isn't it, away from a regulated system?
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt about that. That this would require a sort of sea change, because the other thing that this does, if these sort of more overarching competencies, speaking in the language of competencies, are actually important, it does draw into question why you need so many detailed competencies at a lower level. You have the development of technical competence or the achievement of competencies at a different sort of level from those that are actually available sort of now. And it is a shift to a developmental view of expertise, a view that, you know, your learning and development isn't finished. It can't be easily accommodated at a particular level, because the interesting thing here is that, and I met this is a real example, there was somebody with a PhD in materials science in the supply chain network, and he was saying he needed to need support in terms of developing his communication skills, which, you know, I mean, in EQF terms, he's got the highest level qualification, and he was saying he needs support learning and development at one of the lowest levels of the sort of EQF. And it's certainly that sense that you're trying to develop people's skills and sort of knowledge all the time and at whatever level in order to achieve the tasks which you're trying to accomplish.
Okay, Alan, do you want to go on with the rest of your presentation? I put up his next slide here, where he's talking about developing a range of generic skills which can support the informal learning and the use of personal networks.
Okay, sort of broadening it not only in terms of the sort of networks, but if you're thinking about the sort of social capital and how you develop within work-related networks, one of the things is that very often you need to develop this range of generic skills in terms of planning, problem solving, communication, and IT management skills. And they do require some sort of informal learning and, once again, the recognition of the context in which you're actually developing those. But very often that would require some short periods of formal learning and reflection upon experience. And I think that that's one of the other ways in which we haven't talked about that, but the critical reflection upon experience and the extent to which you actually change sort of practice and you're seeking to sort of change practice rather than it being used for developmental purposes is something else. But again, you would see that sort of model of where you're developing certain sorts of sets of skills, but it is important to have formal learning and reflection. And certainly the work that we've done on the sort of strategic biographies of people over a lifetime in areas like health, engineering, ICT and so on, shows that if for any reason you decide that you're just going to coast within your present job, then you do put yourself at risk if that job actually sort of ceases to exist. So, you know, there is very clear evidence that we do need that sort of formal learning, reflection, development, and certainly rather than a model of sort of lifelong learning, which says we're all learning all the time or we're all supposed to be learning all the time, with the pressures that puts on people, you know, in terms of if they have their sort of annual review, and if they're not, you know, I've come across nurses or radiographers who are saying they have a problem where people are expecting them to have big plans for continuing professional development, but they just want to do their current job well. And, you know, I've got a certain sympathy for that view, and I think we'd be better off, rather than talking about lifelong learning, to talk about periods of intensive learning across the life course. And that's where you would get this interplay between the informal learning and the formal education and training. And of course, that's a very different model from, you know, the sort of current models we have, where, you know, you've got much clearer distinctions between the formal learning and the informal.
Thanks, Alan.